This program contains explicit content and subject matter which may be unsuitable for some listeners. Discretion is advised.
Smart. Sexy. Kinky. Fun.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud with your host, sex educator, author, and filmmaker, Tristan Taramino. It's sex-positive radio like you've never heard before. Tristan talks about sexuality from every angle with leading authors, experts, artists, and icons. From sex education and sexual politics to BDSM and non-monogamy, nothing is off limits. So get ready to open your mind and expand your horizons. This is Sex Out Loud. And now here's your host, Tristan Taramino.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud, everyone. We are live today, which means you can call and talk to me and my guest and chime in. If you want to do that, you can dial up 866-472-5788. 866-472-5788. If you're not listening live, but you have a question or a comment about this show, you can call our 24-hour voicemail line at 323-SEX-8266. 323-SEX-8266. So I sort of got to do a version of this show live without recording it just about a week and a half ago. With this guest because she came to LA and we did an event together at the Pleasure Chest. And so I'm glad to have another opportunity to talk to her. Let me tell you about her. Lynn Camella is Associate Professor of Gender and Sexuality Studies at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. An award-winning researcher, she has written extensively about sexuality and culture for numerous academic publications and popular media outlets. She's interviewed porn legend Nina Hartley, covered the red carpet at the AVN Awards, reported on the business of adult webcamming, and investigated the state of sex education in Nevada. She is co-editor of the comprehensive book New Views on Pornography, Sexuality, Politics, and the Law, and a frequent media contributor. In her new book, Vibrator Nation, she takes a deep dive into the making of the consumer market for sex toys, tracing its emergence from the early 1970s until today. Drawing on more than 80 in-depth interviews with retailers and industry insiders, including her own stint working on the retail floor as a vibrator clerk, she brings readers onto the sex shop floor and into the fascinating world of sex-positive capitalism and cultural production. Welcome, 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 Lynn Camella.
Thank you, Tristan. Thank you. It's good to be on the show with you, and it was great to see you just a couple of weeks ago in LA, and thank you again for joining me for that really fun event at the Pleasure Chest, which
I got a really cool t-shirt out of it.
Yes, you did.
Which I've already worn twice, and I love. We'll talk about your cool t-shirts in a minute.
Okay.
So the thing that it strikes me immediately about this book is that unlike some other people, you know, like you didn't start this book kind of like 2 years ago and now it's come to fruition and it's come out. You started this research and this project a really long time ago. So you actually got to track this industry of feminist sex toy stores over a long period of time, which I think is invaluable. That's one of the invaluable parts of the book.
Mm-hmm.
But what got you first interested in saying, I want to write a book about feminist sex shops?
Yeah, well, I mean, the genesis of the project is really, I think, interesting. It didn't start as a book project. I mean, it started in the late 1990s as a seminar paper for a graduate class that I was taking at the time at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. And at that point in time, I was doing a PhD in communication And I was really interested in questions of sexual politics and sexual representation, and particularly those spaces and places where female sexuality assumes some kind of public presence. And all these questions were swirling around in my head, and it just so happened that a feminist sex toy store had opened in Northampton, Massachusetts, where I was living at the time, and that business was called Intimacies. And it was a wonderful shop. And I thought, well, I'll make this, you know, feminist sex toy shop the object of this seminar paper that I have to write. I'll do a little mini ethnography. So I did that. And it, from the first interview I ever did, just never kind of lost my interest. It was just a compelling subject because it was clear right away that, you know, the retailers that had started these businesses were really working hard to find a way to make all sorts of things that you wouldn't necessarily think could work together, right? So what does it mean to practice feminist politics through the marketplace? How can you kind of bring feminist sex positivity into a retail context? How do you balance identity politics and marketplace culture, sex education and profitability, social change, and, you know, keeping your doors open because you have to be financially solvent? So, you know, I wrote this paper one semester and then decided I wanted to write a PhD dissertation on the history and retail culture of feminist sex toy stores. And then that dissertation eventually morphed into what is now this book. So it really went through different iterations, and I should say different iterations that reflected a changing marketplace, right? I mean, that's one of the things that I hope the book conveys, that, you know, feminist sex toy stores are dynamic in part because the marketplace is so dynamic and they've had to figure out ways how to remain competitive in an industry where sex toys have now gone mainstream and they're not the only kids on the block anymore doing women-friendly retailing. And so I try to look at some of those shifts and changes throughout the book.
I mean, what's fascinating about the timing of this is, like, when you started this in the late 90s till now is arguably the most dramatic growth the industry has had at every level, at the retail yeah. level, at the manufacturing level, at the marketing level. I mean, and so you got to sort of track it from the beginning when there were,
and that worked out really well. I mean, of course, you know, you can't predict the future when you're going to start a project. But it was very interesting. And I agree. I mean, I think that I was able to see up close and in person some pretty dramatic transformations, a transformation of the industry. And that's one reason why the book took longer than I would have ever envisioned finishing. And part of that was that, you know, I signed my book contract with Duke University Press and thought, oh, a year or two, this book will be out. Well, it just so happened that that was a moment in time where around 2008, you had a lot of mainstream distributors and retailers and wholesalers sit up, and all of a sudden, it dawned on them that, you know, sales from pornography were slumping, adult novelty sales were booming, and who, you know, was at the forefront of those sales? Well, it was women. And it was just a really, really remarkable time to be witnessing the conversations that started to happen, including at adult industry trade shows, you know, that all of these players in the adult industry that for whatever reason hadn't paid that much attention to female consumers, all of a sudden were packing, you know, seminar rooms with their pads of paper and their pens in their hands, and they could not write fast enough to capture every single word that representatives from, you know, Good Vibrations or Babeland were saying on stage as they were talking about their, you know, retailing and merchandising strategies. And what was interesting, and I think you were at some of these trade shows around this time, there mm-hmm. was a complete historical amnesia, right? Like, it was as though, you know, female consumers just fell from the sky one day. And there was no acknowledgement that this had actually been a market that had been in formation for decades. And the people who were leading that charge were these small feminist retailers that, you know, large segments of the industry had ignored for many, many decades.
Well, and I think it's interesting to think that the shops themselves were discovered by the industry, right? So some of these shops had actually been open for a really long time, and it was like, oh my God, wait, what kind of a store do you have? Wait, what do you do? Wait, your primary consumer base is who? Yeah, it was almost like a discovery.
It was interesting for sure.
So we have so much to get into. I have a laundry list of questions. I know I'm probably only going to get to like five of them. But we have to take our first commercial break. I am currently doing this show live from Dallas, Texas. You probably, if you're a listener of the show, maybe knew that I was in Dallas, Texas, but you didn't know I was going to do my show live from Dallas, Texas. But I'm here for a few more days, and I've got a few more things going on that you can come to. Tomorrow, Saturday, October 21st, from 12 to 3 p.m. at the Velvet Curtain, I am doing my workshop, Sex Positions from Mild to Wild. This is a class all about different sex positions and how to put your spin on, you know, classics and unique ones. And the really unique part of it is that I am going to have live demos, which, you know, in this day and age, it's harder and harder to find venues where you can do that. So you're actually going to see some live demos of these sex positions. The online registration has closed, but you can get tickets at the door. So hopefully I'll see you tomorrow at noon. And then on Sunday from noon to 3, Black Sex Geek presents Cultural Competency Training, BDSM, and Polyamory. I'm going to do a training for clinicians all about how to be more culturally competent when your clients come in and want to know more or want to tell you about their BDSM and polyamory practices. There are tickets still available, but they're limited because there's limited space in this. So you can still get tickets online or at the door. You just have to go to puckerup.com, click on tour, and you'll see the link to the Eventbrite. And then finally, Sunday night at 6 p.m., 6 to 9 p.m., kick it up a notch, taking sex to the next level at Sarah's Secret. Sarah's Secret is the largest chain of adult retail stores in the Dallas area, and I'm going to be at the location on North Central Expressway in Plano, Texas. You do need to pre-register for that via Eventbrite. It's $10, but then you get a $10 gift card to the store, so it's basically free. I hope I see some of you at these Dallas events. In the meantime, we're going to take a break for some commercials, and when we come back, more with Lynn Camella talking about how feminist sex toy stores changed the business of pleasure. Stay with us.
Sharpen your pencils and polish your apples because the Pleasure Chest is taking you back to school. The Pleasure Chest is the only adult boutique that offers free weekly workshops through their Pleasure Ed program, which is open to folks of all genders, experiences, and orientations who are looking to increase their sexual IQ. With classes ranging from strap on, get off, to the ultimate O, to spank someone happy, education has never been so stimulating. Attend any workshop at the Pleasure Chest and receive 15% off your purchase that night. Bring a hot study date or pick up some skills yourself. Check out pleasurechest.com for a complete listing of upcoming events nationwide and use the code Tristan at checkout to enjoy a free massage candle with your purchase. Courtesy of the Pleasure Chest.
B-Vibe is a premium collection of anal sex toys. Their products feature different sizes to accommodate users of all shapes, sizes, and experience levels. B-Vibe's high-end designs are couples-friendly, body-safe, and offer innovation aimed to create an exceptional user experience. You know I've got really high standards when it comes to anal toys, and I am in love with these. Plus, they stand behind each item with an easy-to-understand, hassle-free warranty. Dubbed as the Apple of anal, learn how B-Vibe and its premium anal plugs are engaging couples to discover the amazing pleasures of anal play. Visit bvibe.com and use coupon code Tristan to receive 20% off your purchase. Are you LGBTQIA, genderqueer or gender variant, a sex worker, an activist, a polyamorous person? Well, the open list features therapists, sexuality and relationship coaches, traditional and alternative healthcare providers, mediators, lawyers, and more who are poly aware, kink competent, sex positive, queer affirming, and anti-oppression. They work with clients with alternative sexualities and relationship structures, including open relationships, polyamory, ethical non-monogamy, swinging, BDSM, and kink. They serve the unique needs of folks who think and live outside the box. To search for a professional in your area, go to the open list at openingup.net. If you're a professional who'd like to be listed, use the coupon code OPENTRIAL for a free 1-year trial.
Streaming live, the leader in internet talk radio, voiceamerica.com.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan at puckerup.com. That's Tristan at puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. That was the voice of Cooper Beckett. And Cooper Beckett and I and a whole lot of amazing people are going to be partying at Desire Cancun very soon when the swing set takes over the entire resort. It's happening November 4th to the 11th. You can find out all about it at ssdesire.com. I hear there's like five rooms left. So if you want to pick up and go somewhere sex positive and lovely, that's all inclusive, that's adults only, I think you should join us. I know that I am going to blow off some steam in a serious, serious way. So I hope to see you in Cancun. I'm talking today with Lynn Camella about her brand new book, Vibrator Nation, How Feminist Sex Toy Stores Changed the Business of Pleasure. Lynn, at the heart of this book, I mean, at the heart of this movement is the story of the late Joni Blank and her founding of the store Good Vibrations, which really sets kind of the gold standard of what the template for these feminist sex shops looks like then as they pop up in various places around the country. And so give me, for people who may not know the backstory, like what were Joni's basic philosophies in opening this store?
Yeah. Well, Joni Blank was just a fascinating, vibrant, whip smart woman. I mean, just, you know, if anyone ever had the pleasure of meeting her, I mean, it was an experience. You know, she really could kind of command your attention and was a great storyteller. So Joni, prior to starting Good Vibrations in 1977, had worked as a sex therapist, a sex educator, and had already started to write books about sexuality. And so even before she started Good Vibrations, she founded her own press called Down There Press. And basically, it was a moment in time in the early 1970s where there were lots of new sexual discourses that were circulating, especially pertaining to female sexuality. And so you had Betty Dodson's book, Liberating Masturbation. You had kind of writings that were coming out of the feminist movement that were drawing attention to the politics of the female orgasm and the politics of heterosexuality. So women were being encouraged to learn about their bodies, and they were being told that masturbation was a vehicle through which women could get in touch with their sexuality and learn about their bodies, and that vibrators were a tool that could help them in their sexual exploration and in their own sexual self-pleasure. So a lot of women were saying, that's great. I love this idea. I would love to get my hands on a vibrator. but where do I go? Where do I go to get a vibrator where I don't have to feel like I'm putting on, you know, armor to kind of walk into a conventional adult store where the only people there are men, they're going to leer at me, they might even harass me. And these were stories that people like Joni were hearing pretty frequently. And so as a sex counselor, she was giving women, you know, this advice to, you know, try to get your hands on a vibrator if you can. And it just reached a point where she just thought, okay, there's a need. There is a need for women to have places where they can comfortably buy these products that they're being encouraged to purchase. I'm going to roll up my sleeves. I'm going to jump into this. I'm going to start a vibrator shop. And I'm going to kind of make it especially but not exclusively for women. And it's going to be warm and inviting. And I'm going to run the shop. And I'm going to sit there all day long. And even if only two people come in, I'm going to answer whatever questions they have about sex. And it doesn't even matter if they don't buy anything. I'm here to be a resource. So she brought all of her background, all of the training that she had accrued over the years in the field of sex therapy, in the field of sex education, the philosophy of sex positivity, which was very much the foundation for a lot of what was going on, especially in San Francisco in the early 70s. And she just, you know, as kind of second nature, brought that all to bear on this tiny little vibrator shop in San Francisco and literally just kind of sat there and waited for people to discover her shop. So there were lots of things that made Good Vibrations really groundbreaking, but a lot of it had to do with the fact that Joni Blank wasn't just a kind of vibrator enthusiast, although she was, but she had this whole background as a sex professional. And, you know, she literally, I think I call that chapter where I talk about the early days of Good Vibrations out of the out of the therapist's office and into the vibrator shop. And that was kind of the trajectory, right, that she kind of moved from a clinical counseling setting and brought all this information into her little tiny sex shop. So that was an important piece of this, right? We're going to be informative. We're going to be accessible. We're going to be non-judgmental. We're going to have the best of the best that's out there in the mid-1970s, which were just a handful of electric vibrators and a couple of books. So that was a really key piece of the foundation of her business. But what made Joni even more remarkable, and I think what really kind of made, allowed for the Good Vibrations retail model to travel in the way that it has traveled to all these different cities across the country, is that Joni Blank had a really alternative vision of being a business person. She didn't like to think of herself as a business person. She was much more comfortable with thinking of Good Vibrations as a social service agency. So she bought into this alternative philosophy of running a business whereby she was willing to share information with anybody who asked her for information. The financial records of the company were open, not just to people within the company, but anybody who might want to come in off the street and see how much money are you making, or as the case often was, how much money are you losing? So this alternative philosophy around business meant that she just really wanted more businesses like Good Vibrations to open. So when the founders of Babeland came to her in the early 90s and said, "We want to start a store like yours in Seattle," she said, "Great, come on down. We will train you, Claire Kavanaugh. We'll teach you everything that we know how to do. We'll give you a feminist sex toy shop starter kit that you can take back to Seattle, and you can run your own business using our core philosophy and our retail strategies." And Babeland did that, and Grand Opening in Boston did that. And then since then, people who've worked for those businesses have gone off and started their own retail stores as well.
My favorite chapter by far in this book is where you talk about how these stores, Good Vibrations at the beginning, and then the stores that model themselves after Good Vibrations, wanted to define themselves as safe and welcoming for women. And in order to do that, they had to almost demonize like traditional adult bookstores. And they also began to silently, but very, but maybe obviously, market to a specific definition of a woman. Can we talk about that part?
Yeah. I mean, I think that was a really interesting chapter for me to write. And for those who are listening that haven't read the book, you know, the chapter is really trying to engage with the ways in which feminist sex toy stores have historically mobilized a lot of distinctions in order to carve out a niche for themselves in the marketplace. And what I mean by that is, you know, I was conducting interview after interview, and I was hearing people very non-self-reflexively talk about the fact that, well, we're classy, not tacky. We're respectable. We're not, quote-unquote, sleazy, right? And so it was very important for a lot of retailers, but also people who worked at those stores, to distinguish themselves from, you know, this idea of the traditional sex toy shop, which was, in their minds, you know, kind of geared towards men and came with all of these very loaded class connotations that weren't necessarily being acknowledged, and also racial connotations as well. So I wanted to really try to tease some of those larger discourses and sets of messages, you know, apart. Like, what were the things that were being insinuated but not explicitly stated about these stores, and about the ways in which they really worked to kind of make themselves legitimate in the eyes of not just customers, including female customers, but entire communities, right? Because if you can position your store as a sexuality boutique or an educational resource center, then, you know, you're more likely to be received favorably by...
I mean, you're not subject to these insane zoning laws. You can get a loan from the bank. The neighbors won't try to drive you out, right?
Yeah, so all of those things. And so, I mean, you know, certainly some of these businesses have had to contend with zoning ordinances. However, it's been far easier for them to make a case for why they shouldn't be, you know, considered a traditional adult-oriented business, because they cater to women, they cater to people that want information and education. And increasingly, you know, I had retailers say, all I had to do at a community board meeting was say, this is a store like Good Vibrations. And people would be like, oh, okay, we get it. Oh, now we see what you're trying to do, right? So what ended up happening was, you know, that the model of retailing, you know, that they were putting in place ended up really kind of creating a sense of sexual respectability that we could kind of locate in an idealized version of a female consumer who was white, presumably heterosexual, middle or upper middle class with disposable income, and who needed a fair amount of hand-holding, right? Like, that's the other thing. Like, we need to create really, really safe spaces for even the most timid woman who might have never imagined herself walking into a sex toy shop, but is curious, you know, nonetheless. So that, I'm glad you liked that chapter. That was the hardest chapter to write, you know, because I think it's really challenging to kind of analyze the things that are there, but nobody's being explicit about it.
Yes, precisely. And that's why it was so compelling and eye-opening. Okay, we've got to take another commercial break. I'm not done with this chapter. I have a million more things to say about it. And there's so much more to dig into in this book. So everyone, listen to our sponsors, and they keep the lights on, and I love them. And when we come back, more all about Vibrator Nation with Lynn Camella in a minute.
Sharpen your pencils and polish your apples, because the Pleasure Chest is taking you back to school. The Pleasure Chest is the only adult boutique that offers free weekly workshops through their Pleasure Ed program, which is open to folks of all genders, experiences, and orientations who are looking to increase their sexual IQ. With classes ranging from strap on, get off, to the ultimate O, to spank someone happy, education has never been so stimulating. Attend any workshop at the Pleasure Chest and receive 15% off your purchase that night. Bring a hot study date or pick up some skills yourself. Check out pleasurechest.com for a complete listing of upcoming events nationwide and use the code Tristan at checkout to enjoy a free massage candle with your purchase, courtesy of the Pleasure Chest. B-Vibe is a premium collection of anal sex toys. Their products feature different sizes to accommodate users of all shapes, sizes, and experience levels. B-Vibe's high-end designs are couples-friendly, body-safe, and offer innovation aimed to create an exceptional user experience. You know I've got really high standards when it comes to anal toys, and I am in love with these. Plus, they stand behind each item with an easy-to-understand, hassle-free warranty. Dubbed as the Apple of anal, learn how B-Vibe and its premium anal plugs are engaging couples to discover the amazing pleasures of anal play. Visit bvibe.com and use coupon code Tristan to receive 20% off your purchase. Are you LGBTQIA? Genderqueer or gender variant, a sex worker, an activist, a polyamorous person? Well, the open list features therapists, sexuality and relationship coaches, traditional and alternative healthcare providers, mediators, lawyers, and more who are poly aware, kink competent, sex positive, queer affirming, and anti-oppression. They work with clients with alternative sexualities and relationship structures, including open relationships, polyamory, ethical non-monogamy, swinging, BDSM, and kink. They serve the unique needs of folks who think and live outside the box. To search for a professional in your area, go to the open list at openingup.net. If you're a professional who'd like to be listed, use the coupon code OPENTRIAL for a free 1-year trial.
The Internet's number one talk station. Number one talk station. VoiceAmerica.com.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan@puckerup.com. That's Tristan@puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. We're talking all about Lynn Camella's new book, Vibrator Nation. And we started talking, getting into this before the break. I want to continue. It's really interesting to think that as these companies were trying to make themselves distinct and explain who they were and what they were doing and how they were different, they were also reinforcing some like outdated and not inclusive notions around class and race and gender and sexuality. And so I just thought that was interesting because it gave me a whole kind of new perspective on like, oh, we're defining it by like what we're not. And then in some ways that's making the what we're not even more shameful.
Yeah.
And one of the things that immediately came to mind was, so one of the tenets of the feminist sex shop is that we display toys out of their packaging. And the reason you display toys out of their packaging is two reasons. One is you absolutely want people to be able to touch and feel the size of something, the weight of it, the material, the vibration, the power of the vibration, hear how loud the vibration is. Like these are all really important things to be able to do. Otherwise, you're looking at a box and you're like guessing what might be in there.
Right.
But then the second piece was that in the very beginning, all the packaging was really garish and tacky and usually looked super like porny, either had porn stars on it or had these sort of like made up women who looked like porn stars kind of like bending over and sticking their tongues out at you and giving you like a come hither glance with no mention of like even what the product was, right?
Right.
And so, but then when, in reading this chapter, it became clear to me that one of the things that we were doing, because I worked at Babeland, so I was like part of this. One of the things that these stores are doing is like there's almost a paternalistic protection of a certain kind of woman. Like, almost like, let's not offend their delicate sensibilities. We don't want to show pictures of, like, half-naked women to other women. That's just gross. You know, well, almost like condescending.
Yeah, I mean, I think paternalism is a good word to use in this case. And in this particular chapter, when I'm kind of writing about this, you know, idealized female consumer that was operating at different stores, but it was certainly operating quite powerfully, you know, throughout the 1990s or early 1990s at Good Vibrations, that a lot of people that I interviewed would talk about the stereotype of the Marin housewife. Right? That's who they kind of were being encouraged to think about. So here you had, you know, lesbians and kind of queer dykes working on the sex shop floor and, you know, being out and proud with their queerness. And then you'd have a manager say, hey, you know, this is all great and we want to kind of definitely be a space that's inviting to all sorts of people, but who we really, really want to make sure we're inviting to is a particular subset of female consumers, right? That kind of white suburban Marin housewife who might be, you know, a little bit more trepidatious than the dyke who's living in the Mission, for example. And so we can't lose sight of that customer. We can't be so kind of, you know, out there in our own sexual sensibilities that we risk being a place that doesn't feel comfortable for this subset of consumers because we also need their money. You know, we need them to kind of shop in our store. So everything was, I think, always, you know, it was very interesting. Like, a lot of these times, these conversations would happen. I mean, I talked to so many people from Babeland and Good Vibrations and other businesses that talked about just the exhaustive debates that they would have as staff about what are we a feminist business? What does feminism mean? What does it mean to be a feminist business? Do we hire men? Do we market to men? If we hire men, what does that, can we still call ourselves, you know, women run? I mean, all of these, you know, things that ended up being not just casual conversations, but really difficult debates. And they were debates around gender. They were debates around sexual orientation. There were certainly debates around race and racism. But I think a number of people said oftentimes what really helped was when they had data from marketing surveys. Even if those marketing surveys were rather rudimentary, it allowed staff to see, okay, here's the breakdown of our customers. Are we going to not market to men when men are 50% of our customers? Are we going to not market to women in the suburbs when our data is showing that, you know, a big percentage of our customer base actually resides in the suburbs? So that marketing data ended up kind of helping with some of these discussions and debates. But, you know, identity politics is just, you know, front and center in the history of these businesses. And there's nothing fixed or stagnant around discussions of identity because, you know, all of these conversations, you know, have over time shifted and evolved. And these businesses have had to learn how to bend with these discussions around men, around hiring trans employees, around, you know, race and racism. You know, it was true that, you know, a number of these stores, including Good Vibrations, had at a certain point of time developed reputations as being like, you know, a store for white women. And, you know, they had to reckon with that and you know, really think about what that reputation meant for them and how they could shift that. And so, you know, the whole kind of sexual respectability piece, I think it's there. It's really there. And I remember early on in my research just, you know, finally like the light bulb going on, thinking, you know, these businesses are identified as strongly by what they are not as they're identified by what they are. You know, like the ways in which they push against that stereotype of an adult store is front and center in the history of these businesses and how they see themselves and like you've already mentioned, how they position themselves within their respective locales and communities and try to gain legitimacy through kind of tipping their hat to a respectable form of female sexuality.
And this reminds me of a real life experience I had, which is when I worked at Babeland, there was another person who worked there who went on to work there for actually 10 years. And we were sort of, you know, casually, not really formally, in charge of like the video rental program. It's the 90s, you know, and so Good Vibrations had this, you know, amazing curated video library that was begun and curated for quite a long time by Susie Bright. And so that was one of the things we did. And I remember asking her one day, you know, we would go through the videos, we'd watch them, we'd say, yeah, yes to this, no to this, yes to this, no to this. And I said to her one day, like, so like, what's your like favorite video? Like, what's the stuff you're watching right now? And she was like, she was reticent. She just didn't want to, like, you know, jump right on it. And I was like, what? And she was like, well, we don't carry it at Babeland.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I said, well, so, okay, so what is it? And she told me it was this, it was a director who was around for a short period of time, Jack the Ripper, the Zipper, Jack the Zipper. And he used to warn that, you know, sometimes people would be kidnapped and sort of taken to a house and there would be group sex. And, you know, it was edgy and it was rough. It was rough around the edges. And I was like, oh, my God, I love Jack the Zipper. And so then we had this moment where we locked eyes and we're like, wait, you're a woman. I'm a woman. We're both saying we like this porn. It turns us on. It gets us off. But we were like, oh, but of course, like, we can't put it in the library here. And then we, like, laughed it off.
That's so interesting. That, I mean, that makes me think of so many, many things. But it makes me think of a couple things that I'll just toss out there, which is, you know, in the kind of early pioneering days of feminist vibrator shops, which would take us back to the 70s with Eve's Garden and the early Good Vibrations, the image of these stores really grew out of the founders' sexual sensibility and what kind of the founders were comfortable with when it came to sex, and also what they thought other women wanted, right? So it was all about vibrators because they wanted to encourage women to learn about their bodies, including and especially the clitoris. And, you know, there weren't kind of dildos available for many years, certainly at Eve's Garden. She had to be kind of coaxed into carrying those. And similarly, I think Susie Bright kind of pulled Joni Blank, you know, along into the 1980s and a different terrain around sexuality. So a lot of these businesses really had certain ideas about what they should be carrying based on their own assumptions, right? The kind of what do women want, which invariably speaks to only some women. Right?
Exactly.
You know, it oftentimes is just not inclusive. But the other thing I want to say about the example that you offered, which is just so interesting and not surprising at all to me, is that I think pornography in particular has been one of those things that has probably caused, you know, the most discomfort for some of these businesses, you know, and Susie Bright, again, had to make a convincing case to Joni Blank about why it mattered whether or not Good Vibrations started to carry a carefully curated selection of erotic videos in the late 80s. And the case she made was, you know, videos can enhance people's sex lives, much, much like a vibrator might, right? So she had to make that kind of political argument. But I write about in the book, this was something that I found so interesting to me. Several years after Good Vibrations started its video library in the late 1980s, Joni Blank and Carol Queen met with the founders of Fatal Video in San Francisco. And part of their discussion was whether or not Good Vibrations would agree to make a kind of sexy video called The Girls of Good Vibrations or The Girls of Good Vibes. So, you know, Carol and Joni thought this was an interesting idea. It could be, you know, a coup for the business and good publicity. And so she wrote up a memo and kind of, you know, talked about the meeting and what this video might look like and kind of took it back to the staff, which I believe was in the early stages of the co-op at that time. And the majority of the staff just went
freaked
ballistic.
Out.
They freaked out. And it was, and I found these memos kind of late in my research, and it was so interesting to me because, you know, it also, it showed, you know, like they were okay having a porn library. They were even okay with the idea of Good Vibrations maybe eventually producing porn, but the fact that there would be a title called The Girls of Good Vibes, they felt completely undermined the wholesomeness and the respectability that they had worked so hard to achieve for the business, for themselves as Vibrator Shop employees. I mean, they went on and on and on about, you know, how much they hated this idea. They did not hold back. They wrote it down. I have those memos.
You have those memos. I mean, they're gems to read the actual memos.
What's also interesting about that is that it's a really good example of the limits of sex positivity, right? Like, it shows that, you know, that these stores do take the tenets of sex positivity really seriously. Like, you know, providing accurate information, not being judgmental, anything goes as long as it's between consenting adults, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But this was one instance where, you know, like, we're going to draw the line here. And it was like almost just universal, you know, with an exception of, I think, Tony and Carol. Like, they smacked that idea down, and they smacked it down hard. So it showed that, you know, it just showed a limit to a lot of things, you know, that sex positivity, even in the context of these businesses, isn't a kind of anything goes, and that people do have a point at which, you know, they feel like they're not comfortable with something. And I heard a lot of some of these lines being drawn when it came to visually explicit sexual imagery, right? Like the erotic videos and pornography, and then even some representations of sexual violence in certain books that became controversial, you know, for the business to carry. So those are interesting examples to me. You know, those moments where you see the staff, like, you know, kind of battling through these issues, but it's also revealing around, like, their own comfort and discomfort, and again, the limits of their own ideas around sex positivity. I thought that was an interesting example.
I mean, like I said, the fact that you have access to, you know, these memos and some of this internal stuff is just so amazing, you know, to record this and archive it for history. But also, there were these, like, battles going on that also reflected larger cultural battles that were happening, whether they were happening within women and feminist communities, whether they were happening within LGBT queer communities. You know, at some point they had to wrestle with all of these different issues as a staff, as a sort of mini community in a larger community that was also wrestling with the issues.
Yeah, exactly, right? It became a microcosm, right? These kind of larger cultural debates, you know, certainly as they were being played out in, you know, bigger feminist circles and bigger queer circles, they were funneling down and playing out in their, you know, own ways within the context of the store. And, you know, certainly pornography is one example of that. You know, the great kind of lesbian dildo debates of the 1970s and 80s was another example of that. Those are kind of well documented and, you know, certainly, you know, produce certain stereotypes that staff had to kind of, you know, push against if you know, some of these stores were going to begin stocking, you know, those early silicone dildos that hit the market. And so, yeah, just, I mean, one of the things, you know, the book tries to kind of take, you know, a historical lens to the emergence and evolution of these businesses, but the chapters, you know, also deal with some of just the key tensions that emerge, whether it's, you know, identity politics and the, you know, marketplace, or, you know, the big one that kind of runs throughout the book is the tension between profitability and social change, you know, how to kind of be a mission-driven business and, you know, at the same time figure out how to sustain yourself profitably as well. And that was just never-ending tension and challenge.
I sort of can't believe that we haven't talked about capitalism. And of course, I had 10 questions about it, but we're literally out of time, Lynn Camilla. Okay, but what I want to say is first of all, to people that Lynn is part of a new wave of academics who are writing smart, thoughtful academic books that are incredibly accessible. This is a total page turner, and it is not full of jargon and theory. So I want to really recommend it to everyone. Anyone can read this book, and it's fascinating. And her discussions of capitalism and this tension, as she says, between feminist politics and capitalism, is a really important one that we're not having enough of those conversations. And this happens to be a subject that comes right at the intersection. And so I can't recommend this book enough, people. I really can't. But then I also have to tell you about what's coming up at the Pleasure Chest and all these things. Okay, so very quickly, let me tell you, the Pleasure Chest has free workshops. You know that. You can go to pleasurechest.com and find out all about them. What's coming up in Los Angeles, October 22nd, Erotic Hypnosis with Simone Justice. October 24th, National Dental Dam Day Celebration, the ultimate O for queer and trans women. October 25th, Suck It, Lick It, Love It with Chelsea and Michelle. In New York City, October 25th, Butt Sex Basics with Ryan and Matan. Again, go to thepleasurechest.com and find out all about those and more. And I want to thank you, Lynn, so much for being on the show.
I wish we had another hour because I would have loved to continue the conversation. We just scratched the surface of the book.
I know. Okay, so everyone, the book is called Vibrator Nation, How Feminist Sex Toy Stores Changed the Business of Pleasure. You can find out about Lynn at lynncamella.com. She's also on Twitter at lynncamella. And there is an Instagram account just for this book where you'll get to see some of the amazing other products that have sprung up around this book, including t-shirts and bags that feature just fantastic vibrator artwork. And that's vibrator_nation on Instagram.
Yes, awesome. And just to, really quickly, I am doing a book tour that goes through this spring. So if you go to my website, you can see some of the cities that I'm going to be visiting. Tomorrow I'll be in Seattle. So if you're a fan of Babeland Seattle and you live in Seattle or close by, 7 p.m. tomorrow night at the store in Seattle.
And I've got a t-shirt and a bag, and I love them so much. The illustrations are fantastic, and they're just clever enough that you can, like, go to the grocery store, and when people who know it's a vibrator, like, give you that knowing look, and then everyone else just sort of thinks you have some, like, cool vintage t-shirt on.
Yeah, so, I'm so glad you love them. I think they're really, really amazing-looking kind of vintage classic vibrator designs, and I'm a big fan of tote bags, so give me a tote bag with vibrator hieroglyphics, and I'm all over it. So yeah. You can check those out at happyorangedesigns.com. There's a number of colors and designs, and that's one way that you can support the book tour as well.
Oh, great. Okay, so that's good. So go buy those t-shirts so that Lynn can keep spreading the gospel of vibrators all around the country. Okay, I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. Executive producer Karen Dana, associate producer Raymond Johnson, announcer Cooper Beckett from Life on the Swing Set, Matt, my regular engineer, but A-Rod on the board today, everyone at Voice America. Remember, if you want to hear this again, you can go to voiceamerica.com and search for Sex Out Loud. You can also subscribe to it as a podcast on iTunes. We're also on Stitcher. There's a whole bunch of ways. And I want to thank Professor Kevin Heffernan at Southern Methodist University for allowing me to record my show live in his study in Dallas, Texas.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you, Kevin. Tune in next Friday, 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern, for another edition of the show. Until then, you can get me on Facebook, on Instagram, and on Twitter at Tristan Terramino. Hopefully, for you Dallas area folks, I will see you this weekend at my events. You can go to my website, puckerup.com, to find out about those. And until the next time you hear my voice, I hope you'll have a conversation about sex out loud.
That's a wrap on today's show. Go to voiceamerica.com to listen to this and other episodes on demand or as podcasts. And make sure you come back next Friday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific, for Sex Out Loud with Tristan Taramino on Voice America Variety.